Next on the Public Radio Hour, as part of our celebration of Black History Month, we'll sample a new documentary we're airing during Morning Blend titled The Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul. We'll also meet the actors and check out a couple of scenes from Fantasy Playhouse Children's Theater's in-school touring program, Freedom Riders.
We really just want them to realize that some of the problems that were happening then are still very much alive today.
We'll have our ears on history all year long as Alabama celebrates its bicentennial with hundreds of events. Sally Warden stops by with the lowdown on amazing things happening in our community and in our schools.
These 18 schools are doing specific projects, but there is a lot going on in the schools. Of course, fourth graders study Alabama history, so this is their year to really shine.
And we'll also check out a sample from a new podcast called Tree of Trust, aimed at using the power of storytelling to dispel the stigmas of mental health problems. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville, our weekly mix of special programs and homemade radio features. I'm your host tonight, Brett Tannehill. Lots of great things coming up in the next 53 minutes, including some powerful storytelling from a new mental health podcast called Tree of Trust, which is, right at this moment, hosting a launch party over at historic Whedon House. Sally Warden with the Huntsville-Madison County Bicentennial Committee stops by for a visit to tell us about some of the amazing community events and projects happening this month as part of the year-long celebration of Alabama's 200th birthday. Hey, we're getting our own stamp. But let's start with a nod toward Black History Month. Every Wednesday at 9 o'clock during Morning Blend this month, we're featuring a new documentary series titled The Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul. We'll hear part of that. Our show begins tonight with a unique history project from Fantasy Playhouse Children's Theater, aimed at bringing live theater into our local schools with a production called Freedom Riders. Freedom Riders is set in the 1950s and 60s and reenacts and reimagines conversations and scenes from the civil rights era, reconnecting young students with these critically important moments in history. Actors Tyrell Woods, Chad Burkhard, and Kelly Burney Reischauer stopped by to talk about the program and act out a couple of scenes. In this scene, Kelly portrays Ann Thompson, a figure connected to the integration of Arkansas's public school system.
Segregation was simply the way of life for us in Arkansas in 1956. My name is Ann Thompson. I was a 15-year-old 10th grader when I found out they were going to integrate my school in Little Rock, Arkansas. The day the students arrived, there was a circus-like atmosphere around the school as our parents urged us not to let them in, and the TV cameras recorded it all. The U.S. Army had to come in to escort 9 Black students into our school. It was like the Civil War revisited and the federal government was taking over Arkansas. I honestly can't remember when I first saw Elizabeth Eckford, the first student to enter the school. I knew immediately something was happening when the noise picked up from the parents and students.
Get that colored out of here.
Go home!
Throughout it all, Elizabeth did not react. You couldn't tell that she heard anything. She held her head slightly downward and just walked.
Whites only.
Not in our school.
Keep our schools white! Even as I was jeering her, I couldn't help but feel sorry for her. I realized how incredibly hard this must all be for her. I mean, to us, when the Black students entered the school, we felt as if they had beaten us. They won and we lost. We knew that Little Rock would never be the same just because 9 students walked through the front door of Central High.
Tell me a little bit about that first scene for the listeners out there who are tuning in. Put it in context. What were they listening to?
Well, the first scene you were listening to, Ann Thompson, who is reflecting on the day that her high school was integrated. There's a very famous photo of Elizabeth Eckford walking through this mob of horrifically angry, screaming people because they did not want their schools to be integrated. And Ann Thompson happened to be one of the teenagers that we're watching. What is interesting is as they became adults and did reach out and apologize, as did some of the students, got together with those nine students to try to make amends.
And as I understand it, Fantasy Playhouse is going into the schools and taking the theater to the kids. Man, that's got to be a little bit intimidating, maybe is the right word, to perform something like that in a school to school kids. What do y'all think about that?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some hesitation maybe at the beginning when we first learned what we were going to have to do. But I think overall the message of what we're trying to bring to the kids is so much stronger than our personal feelings of going out there like that. And I think we wouldn't have signed on if we didn't believe that this was something that needed to be out there and we wanted to be able to give it to the kids. And, you know, nowadays, for this age group, a lot of the people that we talk about in this play, they're not people that they would know as readily as maybe we did at that age. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little different now. And so some of these names, knowing more about them and how they felt and how we're trying to portray them, I think will help maybe understand the plight that we're touching base on here.
And Chad, I think that's a good point, is as the generations move on, these people are not in the forefront of people's minds. They mm-hmm. do have to be reminded of these stories, and the stories have to be retold. And doing it in a theatrical way like this is a really powerful way. And Tyrell, you're playing some pretty big names. How do you feel about that? I mean, you are the embodiment of some of the biggest names in American history.
Yeah, so I play most of the male leads in this play. I play Martin Luther King Jr. I also play Malcolm X and W.E.B. Du Bois, who is, all of them are like the main civil rights. Like when you hear the word civil rights, you think of these people.
Right. So tell me about the second scene that we're going to hear next. What's happening here?
Well, it's actually a conversation between Dr. King and George Wallace, and they're just kind of
a reimagined conversation.
Yeah, reimagined conversation of them getting a chance to maybe touch base on a lot of things that they might have disagreed on a regular basis. So it's very interesting to see if this communication would have happened. This is kind of what the playwright Tom Quinn thought might kind of go through the minds of both individuals and how they would maybe play the game of chess with each other when it comes to politics and what was going on at the time.
We will not ride your buses until you allow the Negro to sit where they like just as a white passenger. We ask for fairness in this small way. Let us hope that the dark clouds of racial prejudice will soon pass away, and the deep fog of misunderstanding will be lifted from our fear-drenched communities. And in the some not too distant tomorrow, the radiant stars of love and brotherhood will shine over our great nation with all their scintillating beauty.
Awfully pretty words there, Dr. King.
Governor Wallace, it's nice to see you again.
Save the pleasantries, Martin. As governor of the great state of Alabama, I don't need you coming around causing any more trouble.
We are not here to cause trouble. Our methods are purely nonviolent.
I know all that passive resistance nonsense. You sit there and wait for my boys, like Police Chief Bull Connor, to come along and bust you upside your head so you can get your picture on the TV news.
We will not strike back. I use the same methods Gandhi did in India. We will resist, whether it be to ride your buses or to vote in your elections, but never with violence. Then if you use violence against us, the world shall see the foolishness of your actions.
The people made me governor, and I may even run for president someday, because they do not want the South to change.
But change it must, and change it will. Perhaps one day, a black man will be president.
President. Now that is the most foolish thing you have ever said. Blacks and whites will not integrate. I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever.
Those are the words of the past, governor.
Those are words of ignorance. Words of fear. We must live together.
I tell you what. You better watch yourself. You may find someone will silence you forever.
And what if they do? Someone else will simply take my place. I get threats on my life every day. I know that each sit-in, each demonstration may be my last. It does not matter. I have seen the promised land, and while I may not get there, I know that my causes are right, and they are just.
You can't change the people's hearts and minds overnight, Dr. King. The South shall resist you with all her might.
I don't care how long it takes. This is no easy road, but I do not walk it alone. I'm giving a speech about the power of freedom in Washington, D.C. I'm gonna let freedom ring in the Lincoln Memorial for all the nation to hear. When we let freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every city and every state, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men, white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will soon be able to join hands and sing the words of the old Negro spiritual. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
One at a time, if you could go through and tell me what you hope the kids get from this when you bring the play to them, when you bring this piece of history alive for them. Starting with you, Tyrell, what do you hope they get out of that?
So like we said earlier, a lot of the kids that we are going to be performing this for are kids who don't really, who weren't really alive when most of this went down. Most of the kids are very young. So I really hope that like we can persuade them and tell them that all of this stuff that happened was real, like it actually happened even here in this state in Alabama. Most of the stuff went down here.
Yeah, I think, you know, just to piggyback on what Tyrell is saying, I think one of the biggest things that we really want to establish with the students who are going to be seeing this, the patrons, is that we really just want them to realize that some of the problems that were happening then are still very much alive today. And it's not easy. And we talk about how, you know, every step that we take, we just need to really think about how we're taking those steps and how we can work together to make things easier for all of us, not just one or another. And so we just really want people to see that this is about community and how we can bring ourselves together and how we need to work together for a better community.
I have a 10th grader and a 7th grader, and I brought each of them to see a run through of the show to get their perspective. And it's been amazing, not just the conversations that they have had with my parents who are alive and witnessed many of the atrocities during the civil rights movement. What I've always raised my children, that they walk out the door with privilege and that it is their job to use that privilege in order to help people of color, to help marginalized communities. And what I love that Tom Quinn did was he buttoned the end of the play, like Chad said, with showing how some of these things still can continue and how until all of us are judged by our character and not our color, no one is free. And so the Freedom Ride, these young, brave humans jumped on a bus and some died for it. Some died for their cause. And it is up to us to continue until we are all free.
Fantasy Playhouse, bringing history alive for Black History Month and beyond. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
But my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day down in Alabama, with its vicious racist, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's cry. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Listening to the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville. Thanks to Chad Burkhard, Kelly Berner Reischauer, and Tyrell Woods from Fantasy Playhouse for talking with us about Freedom Riders, an educational theater project now touring in our local schools where students can experience history on stage and also engage in a question and answer session. Their teachers can also get study guides for the classrooms. Schools can request a performance by contacting Fantasy Playhouse Children's Theater. Title I schools are eligible for free performances. We'll have a link to more information at WLRH.org on the Public Radio Hour podcast page. February is Black History Month, and WLRH is celebrating in part with a documentary series airing Wednesdays at 9 o'clock during Morning Blend. The series is titled "The Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul," and it illustrates the influence of Black gospel music on early rock and soul music. The first episode aired yesterday, and we got a great response, so we thought we'd share it with you, so hopefully you can tune in next Wednesday morning at 9 for Part 2. So, we hope you enjoy this segment from the Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul here on the Public Radio Hour.
You're listening to Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, The Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul. I'm Cece Winans. Starting just over a century ago, hundreds of thousands of African Americans left the South to find better lives elsewhere. In their home region, under Jim Crow, laws regulated just about every part of Black people's lives and segregated them from whites in a caste system passed down from slavery. African Americans held little or no power. Those who began to leave for northern cities and the West Coast were part of the first wave of what we call the Great Migration. One of those migrants was a talented young musician who would go on to revolutionize what gospel music could be.
Now, gospel songwriters come and gospel songwriters go. But did you know I'm the first one that made the market for gospel songs?
This is Thomas Dorsey, who many call the father of gospel music, speaking with radio host Studs Terkel in 1961.
I went to the churches and sang my songs at the end of the service, those who would let me. But all of the singers who came after, or all of the songwriters that came after, they have a part of Thomas A. Dorsey in their songs.
Thomas left his hometown of Atlanta when he was 17. He intended to land in Philadelphia, but ended up in Chicago, where some of his relatives lived. As a teenager playing house parties, he'd already developed into a good pianist with a strong ear. So the blues crowd started calling on him in his new home city.
When I last night had a great big fight, everything seemed to go around.
I accompanied Ma Rainey for several seasons.
Ma Rainey was a star and one of the first blues singers to cut a record.
I wrote several blues. I suppose I wrote, recorded, worked on, and played on more than 200 blues songs back in that area.
Folks said I'm crooked. I didn't know where she took it. I want the whole world to know.
But something was working his nerves. The late nights in Chicago blues clubs weren't doing him any good. A minister advised him to stay off that circuit, to use his music to praise God. Only that could heal him. He gave it a try.
I was standing by the bedside of a neighbor who was just about to cross the swelling tide.
He would bring his suitcase full of gospel songs to try to sell to the pastors.
Those pastors weren't buying. Bob Maravich, the editor of the Journal of Gospel Music, says this is what they told him.
This was the devil's music. This was an embarrassing reminder of our past. We did not want anyone playing this fan dancing music in our church.
Thomas struggled to make ends meet as a gospel songwriter. Saturday night, he worked blues gigs and played churches on Sunday mornings.
Tell them I am coming home someday.
Coming home someday.
In 1932, his wife was expecting their first child when he traveled from Chicago to St. Louis.
And he said, I'll be back.
Again, Bob Maravich.
He went to St. Louis for a gospel workshop, and he found out that she was gravely ill in childbirth when he was there. He hurried back to Chicago only to find out that Nettie, his wife, had passed away the night before. But his day-old child was alive. So he was very despondent about his wife, very thankful that his son was alive, but the next day his son died.
In his despair, Thomas spent 3 days alone in a room with a piano. He emerged from that isolated grief with a new vision and with a new composition that became an enduring gospel hymn, Take My Hand, Precious Lord.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on. Let me stand.
Bob Maravich told us, and many others agree, that Precious Lord exemplified what gospel music was for.
It was his Dorsey story, but as you would say, the congregants just wrecked that church when they heard it.
For them, it became an anthem.
It was a chance for migrants and old settlers together to say, you know what? We are grieving about what has happened in our own lives.
It's a song that expresses profound sadness, a song that expresses compassion. I feel the power and history of Precious Lord every time I sing it.
Precious Lord is looking at the styles, different styles of black music of the time, talking about blues, talking about jazz, talking about spirituals.
Gospel historian Lucius Bell Jr.
So taking those experiences into his religious experiences, then he came up with a sound, and that sound is evident in Precious Lord.
And when my way draw near.
That sound reached bigger and bigger audiences. Not just because he wrote timeless, important songs like Precious Lord and Peace in the Valley, but because he knew how to hustle. He founded a national gospel convention that continues to this day. The musician people used to call Barrel House Tom also became the first black publisher of gospel music.
And he had people who would go out to church congregations all around the country.
Gospel historian Jerry Zoltan.
They would teach this new style of singing gospel. They would bring the sheet music. And I think that their influence in the world of gospel was probably more within churches as opposed to the groups that were out there trying to make a living at it.
The music church folks had rejected because it reminded them too much of the down-home blues became the cornerstone of gospel music.
I don't see any harm in the music. Blues, jazz, gospel, hymns. The music is just music, and what a sordid place this world would be without any music. So we've got to have music.
His blues beats and notes also launched a great gospel singer's career.
Precious Lord, take my hand.
Thomas and Mahalia Jackson formed an alliance. The singer, a New Orleans native, would perform his new compositions at churches across Chicago. Their musical relationship culminated at one of the lowest points of American 20th century history, when Mahalia sang Precious Lord at Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral. Mahalia was Dr. King's favorite singer, and Precious Lord was one of his favorite songs. She told Studs Terkel that sometimes King would phone and ask her to sing that song.
It's something like a doctor giving you one of those vitamin tablets. It revives you, let you know that, as Dr. Martin Luther King said, walk together, children, don't you get weary. There's a great camp meeting in the Promised Land. And this Promised Land is right here in America.
Like Mahalia, Thomas rose at the same time conditions changed for countless African Americans. In his music, he conveyed the hope and worry they felt as they started new lives in new cities. As he was finding his footing up north, Jubilee gospel quartets were blazing a trail in the South. His success set the table for those musicians to make their way north in the coming years. Audiences wouldn't know what hit them.
We hope you enjoyed that special presentation of The Gospel Roots of Rock and Soul, a documentary series airing each Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock this month during Morning Blend as part of our Black History Month programming. This is the Public Radio Hour, a weekly mix of special programs and homemade radio features. Let's keep our minds on history as we look back to Alabama's earliest days. This is Alabama's bicentennial year, and there are hundreds, literally hundreds, of amazing things happening all year long all across the great state of Alabama. Sally Warden with the Huntsville-Madison County Bicentennial Committee will be paying us a visit each month to update us on things to do in our community.
And Sally, lots of amazing bicentennial events kicking off this month. And let's start with Huntsville's historic Weeden House, which is also celebrating its 200th birthday. Currently, it's featuring an exhibit of watercolor paintings of freed slaves painted by the person most famously associated with that museum.
That's exactly right. They have gone and collected their pictures that Maria Howard Weeden has painted from private collections, from other museums. They have them all there at Weeden House for the month of February. As a matter of fact, on Wednesdays, it's Weeden Wednesdays, and it is free to go in and take a tour and see these.
I heard it's the largest display ever of Miss Weeden's work.
Exactly. You know, one interesting thing you mentioned was about the most famous resident of the Weeden House. There actually was another famous resident of the Weeden House, and that's John McKinley, who happened to be the first Alabamian ever appointed to the Supreme Court. We'll be having an activity for him in March at the Weeden House.
Have you had a chance to see the exhibit yet?
I have seen pictures there. I've seen the ones that they have on display regularly, their own collection. I have not yet seen the ones that have been brought in from private collections and other museums.
We have that as one of our PSAs that we're running right now. So that's on my bucket list for this week, is to go check out the watercolors at Weeden House. So also, speaking of art, at the Museum of Art, an interesting exhibit now on display through March 24th titled Our Shared Heritage, featuring work by Alabama artists.
Exactly. They actually had a big opening with a special speaker reception back when they opened at the end of, actually just the end of January, just a few days ago. And these are from their own collection of Alabama artists. These are historic paintings, actually, that they are running throughout the month of February and March. After that, coming in the months to follow, they're actually bringing in contemporary Alabama artists that they'll have on display.
And speaking of museums, it's Dr. Burritt's 150th birthday up at Burritt Museum.
There are just a lot of birthdays to being celebrated in 2019, and Dr. Burritt's is one. And so they will have all sorts of exciting activities. Actually, his birthday was in February, so take a look at their website to see what there is going on in February up at Burritt Museum to celebrate his birthday.
And as we were talking before the interview, one of the neat things that you mentioned happening this month, not having anything to do with art and history, but it's the Alabama stamp dedication and unveiling that's happening on February 23rd down at Constitution Hall. Tell me a little bit about this. This sounds like a big deal.
It is a big deal. You know, several years ago when I got involved in the bicentennial, we talked about we've got to get a stamp. Well, little did we know that the United States Postal Service had been creating stamps to celebrate bicentennials of the states. And as it sort of moves from east to west as states were formed,
right,
they already had it in the works. Because the picture, and I wish that there was some way that I could show the audience how beautiful the Alabama state stamp is. It is a picture that was taken up on Mount Cheehaw from Pulpit Rock. It's a photograph. No one is ever going to want to use another stamp besides this one again. It is a beautiful stamp depicting Alabama, really the essence of Alabama outdoors. And it will be unveiled and dedicated on February the 23rd.
Is that when it will be available to the public?
It will. Matter of fact, the first day of issue, this is all will all be taking place that Saturday morning. We will have the legislators all here that weekend because we want them to be involved in the dedication of the Alabama stamp. They'll be here for all sorts of activities, but the very public portion will be at 10 o'clock on that Saturday morning, the 23rd. They will unveil the stamp, they will dedicate it, and then the U.S. Postal Service will be set up to sell first day of issue stamps. So we'll have all sorts of stamp collectors there to get their first day of issue.
Oh, very cool. And dear listeners, we'll have a picture of that stamp up on our website with this podcast for the Public Radio Hour at WLRH.org. You can also check out the WLRH Facebook page, the Alabama Bicentennial Stamp Dedication, February 23rd, 10 a.m. at Constitution Hall Park. And also, another cool thing happening this month, Yellowhammer Brewing is releasing a bicentennial beer. So how does that work?
Well, you know, the Yellowhammer Brewing name, Yellowhammer, is our state bird.
Right.
Little did I realize, actually, until I got involved in this, that all of their beers have some Alabama
tilt
to their name.
Yeah.
Something is, well, I'll tell you what, long before we started thinking about the bicentennial, Yellowhammer was thinking about 1819 and the year we became a state. They have had this beer that they is a basically a winter beer. They have been brewing this actually each year to commemorate Alabama's birthday for several years. Their marketing team has been waiting for 2019 for literally 5 or 6 years. And because they've come out with new cans, they have a new commemorative can, commemorative growlers that this beer is in. It is a double, I believe that's how you say that word. It is a smooth brown ale, and it is available in their tap room as well as at any restaurant and retail outlets throughout Alabama that sell craft beer.
One of the neat components to this year-long bicentennial celebration is how local schools are getting involved and being collaboratively involved with events and getting students tied into what's going on. First, if one of our listeners happens to see one of our public schools flying the 200-year bicentennial flag on its flagpole, what does that mean? The school's a bicentennial school. What is that?
Well, actually, any school can get that flag. Any school in the whole state can get that flag. It's one of my goals is to make sure every single school has that bicentennial flag flying sometime this year. But the state had a program where they decided that they wanted the public schools to do community service projects in honor of Alabama's 200th birthday. These projects did not have to be historical in nature, but they did have to have a community service aspect. Very proud that there are 18 schools in Madison County, both all three public schools as well as private schools, that were awarded a grant in order to pursue those community service projects. And they are awesome. They
give us an idea about some of these community service projects. What are some of your favorites?
They cover everything. Challenger Middle School is working on rewriting the Constitution. I don't know if the 1901 Constitution we're on is literally a foot deep. Well, their civics classes, actually the entire school, their 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, they are working on setting up a debate about the current Constitution, as well as seeing what they can do to draft a better Constitution for Alabama that is not so unwieldy. Great project that they are doing. They'll have the community in to see the debates and help them in rewriting the Constitution.
Are the debates coming later in the year?
They are. It'll all be between now and the end of the school year.
That sounds really amazing.
Other projects, some schools are having reading clubs that are getting more reading involved with the community. There are board game clubs that, again, a community service aspect, getting some of the elderly involved and getting into the school. One school is doing a parent resource center that actually will have its grand opening in several weeks. There is another school that has put together an awesome, and this one is historical in nature, virtual field trip. There are over 2,500 historical markers in Alabama, and they are putting together with their history students and their computer science students, this is Buckhorn High School, actually, they are putting together, they are putting together an app where you can go and take virtual field trips of all of the 20, eventually they'll have all of them. This year they're taking 200. They're doing it bits at a time, so this will be an ongoing project.
That sounds amazing.
Well, also, you know, up in that area, the northeast area of the county, has such rich history. It's where the settlers first came when they were moving this direction. And Riverton Elementary School, which recently celebrated its 100th birthday, has an exciting project. Actually, in their school grounds, it was the site of the Battle of Buckhorn Tavern in the Civil War. So they are making an outdoor classroom overlooking the Flint River that not only will those students use, it'll be open for any students in the area to come as well and see a little history at work right there.
We'll have to keep closer tabs on this as you come back and tell us more through the year as we go month to month.
Well, I just encourage the listeners, you know, if they've got children in school, they need to find out what's going on in their school, because these 18 schools are doing specific projects, but there is a lot going on in the schools. Of course, fourth graders study Alabama history, so this is their year to really shine.
Are there any other things looking further out into the year that you've really kind of got your eye on as being something special that we should know about now?
Well, there are several, but there are also some ongoing projects that I'd like to mention first, if I could, Brett, because the Huntsville-Madison County Library has actually taken all 200 years of Alabama history, broken it up chronologically by the month, and are having special programs every month focusing on a set of decades throughout that 200 years. I believe in January they talked about our territory days. Now they've moved a little bit further down the timeline in Alabama history, but they have a special reading list, an online timeline. They'll have special speaker series addressing topics of interest for that particular set of decades, as well as traveling exhibits and their own exhibits that they'll have out. So that's something ongoing. Check out what's happening every single month down at the Huntsville-Madison County Public Library.
And it's good that you mentioned that, because the library and so many other nonprofits and community events are doing their own little bicentennial. We just kind of went through a few of them, but there's There's just a number of things happening.
We, I literally have 75 partners in Huntsville-Madison County that I am working with that are working on activities that are bicentennial related. And that's not even to mention all the Apollo-related activities that a lot of them are doing as well.
Yeah, the Apollo 11 anniversary is going to be huge in July.
And that will be focused, although there are things ongoing all the time right now with that. But and you know, one thing that's in, that I need to point out is that when we talk about Alabama history, we're not just talking about what happened 200 years ago. We're talking about everything that's happened since we became a state. And that certainly in this area is a big part of that makes us what we are and something we should be very proud of.
And you mentioned you're with the Huntsville-Madison County Bicentennial Commission, but this is a statewide thing. So if you have this much happening just here, Huntsville-Madison County, multiply that by all the other counties.
Yes.
So are there any other things happening across the state that you're kind of like, ooh, that's going to be really neat?
Well, one thing I need to tell you, though, not only what we've done is what the state has done is set up over 200 local committees like ours, either based in the county or based in municipalities. Here in Madison County, both Triana turns 200 in 2019 and Madison turns 150. They both have very active committees that are churning out activities for their that are specific to their communities. But all over the state, over 200 committees are doing like we are doing. Some are doing
anything
it very
special
different.
That you've
well,
got your
I'll
eye
tell
on?
You this.
You get one.
There, okay, here's one which is going to be awesome. This is down in Tuscaloosa County. Leave it to Tuscaloosa to be able to bring in some of the biggest Alabama stars there are. I will be back with you with the date of this because it's free to the public. It's going to be at their amphitheater. They are bringing in all sorts of Alabama stars. Big, big names, and it's going to be a free concert.
Oh, wow. We'll have to keep tabs on that.
Yes.
Absolutely. So, Sally, you'll be coming back month to month to sort of update us and keep us in touch with what's going on. Why do you think this is such a special thing that people need to connect with and get involved with? What does the public get out of going and experiencing any of these hundreds and hundreds of events that are going on?
Well, you know, we have a lot to be proud of here in Alabama, and especially here in North Alabama. Huntsville was the birthplace of Alabama. It's where the Constitutional Convention took place. It was a lot of our forefathers from Madison County that were instrumental in writing the Constitution that led us into being a state. And my goal, our goal on this committee, is to make sure that everyone experiences something about the bicentennial. It doesn't necessarily have to be something super historical that they have to go out and learn facts from 200 years ago. We want to meet them where they are. Every arts organization in town is doing some sort of performance that is either bicentennial-based or Apollo-based. We want those folks that love the ballet to learn a little bit about history. We want those folks that love history to learn a little bit about the ballet. So there's that cross-mingling, and they understand about our history and about how it applies to them now.
That was Sally Warden with the Huntsville-Madison County Bicentennial Committee, updating us on amazing community events and projects happening in February related to the year-long celebration of Alabama's 200th birthday. You can find a comprehensive list of bicentennial events on the Huntsville-Madison County Convention and Visitors Bureau website at huntsville.org. And you can always find tons of things to do on our community calendar at WLRH.org, where you can also find a podcast of tonight's Public Radio Hour. You can also find podcasts of all of our programming on iTunes. back in November as part of our year-long coverage of mental health issues in 2018. We talked with Melissa Ford Thornton and Christy James about a new podcast they were building called Tree of Trust. Their goal was to use the power of storytelling to dispel the stereotypes and stigmas often attached to people dealing with mental health issues. Each episode features a special guest, regular people just like me and you, and their stories of overcoming the hardships life inevitably throws our way. Well, tonight's the night as Tree of Trust goes live. A launch party is underway right this moment at Huntsville's historic Whedon House. To close out our show tonight, let's sample a bit of the first Tree of Trust episode.
Thanks for joining us. Today, our special guest is Gary Jenkins, professional comedian, actor, and musician. He's a triple threat and all-around great guy. Today, Gary invites us into a story he first shared at the Nashville production of Listen to Your Mother, a national storytelling show. This is a poignant portrait of growing up, loving, and being loved by someone with mental illness.
On a blistering Alabama day in 1979, I was riding in the back seat of my mom's 69 green Ford Galaxy. Like mom, her car was kid-friendly with floorboards that were ankle-deep in empty Burger King containers, church programs, crumpled Cool Filter King packets, and occasionally our mange-covered mutt, Freckles. Now you know my password. Heading into ninth grade, I was managing scabby zits, a baritone to screechy soprano voice, and an enthusiastic little soldier in my underwear that was constantly volunteering for a mission he did not yet understand. I was embarrassed by everything, but especially mom's car, which was junky and constantly breaking down. We stopped behind a huge military truck that was sitting beyond a stop sign, and mom looked over her shoulder, letting me have both barrels regarding how she was working two jobs, sacrificing everything for my brother and me, and we were unappreciative brats. As she screamed, I could see the truck slowly backing. "Mom," I said, but she was on a roll. "Mom," I said a bit louder, but she was only transmitting. "Mom, look," I pointed. The heavy bumper of the truck began to fold the hood of the Galaxy like an accordion. The metal popped up and the truck kept coming, folding the Detroit steel like a Japanese paper fan. Mom turned forward, screamed, threw the car in reverse, and jumped out. As Mom's driverless Galaxy rolled backward down Bradshaw Drive with me in the back seat, I became oddly calm, climbed over the seat, hit the brakes, and steered back to the scene. A crowd gathered around the two confused military men and me talking to the police, and Mom now lying in the back seat of her Galaxy, sobbing and hyperventilating, pitifully sucking on jagged pieces of ice that passersby had given her. Anyone would be upset over an incident like this, but Mom was devastated. She was often upset and bedridden for weeks for no reason. If something did go wrong like this, or she felt slighted in some way, she could spiral into days of sleepless rants we called fits, where she might viciously attack anyone, including us, verbally or physically. In late 70s, small town Alabama, people didn't talk about mental illness. There was no Oprah. People went crazy or had nervous breakdowns, or they were just weak sinners who needed to try harder, go down front at church, confess, and live a perfect, sinless life. We didn't use words like bipolar, schizophrenia, or schizoaffective disorder. Dinner talk did not include paranoia, involuntary commitment, or Thorazine. It would be many heart-wrenching, difficult years before those words felt familiar in our mouths and ears. We were eventually relieved to find that our family secret, Mom's frustrating moods and terrifying fits, had a name: bipolar and schizophrenia, were beyond her control, and had nothing to do with her character, her sweet disposition, or the devil. Despite our help, she eventually declined in every way, disappeared for weeks, held lesser jobs, suffered innumerable losses and humiliations, and was eventually homeless. Psychotic incidents, police, FBI, institutional commitments, then 15 years of doctors experimenting with different drugs turned my beautiful, funny, vivacious, creative, talented, determined, loving mother into a beaten, withdrawn, quiet, passionless, uninterested, unengaged whisper of who she had been. In 2006, the multiple pack a day cigarette habit caused her heart to stop beating. When we found her, I sat on a small wicker stool beside her bed in stunned silence. All those years, all the craziness, the drama, the hoping, praying, the tears, it was just over. She wasn't going to get better, no matter what I did or said or accomplished. She wasn't going to wear a red sports jacket and sell real estate and have friends and wine parties where she laughed about the tough times. I keep that wicker stool in my closet and sit on it at the beginning of every day when I put on my shoes. It grounds me, reminding me to stay humble, grateful, and loving, because anything can happen to anyone at any time. She drove that smashed Galaxy for a few more years. The folded metal on the hood formed an indention that would fill with water when it rained. We drive around, Mom and me, water sloshing in and out. We laughed once when we saw birds flitting about and bathing in it like a Disney cartoon. The experience of loving and being loved by my mom as she struggled with mental illness, with the soaring highs and soul-crushing lows, was so bittersweet. It affected every moment of my life and forged every part of who I am, the good and the not so good. Now that her struggle is over, I think about what she endured, how hard she tried, how much she overcame, and how much she loved. And I know all that happened is somehow perfect, though it seemed utterly flawed. It is, I believe, perfectly flawed, like me, like you, like life, and like Mom's Galaxy.
I'll go anywhere, try and takes me. I'm ready for the things that I don't know. Whatever I become, whatever comes of me.
A segment from the first episode of the new Tree of Trust Mental Health Podcast. Find more information about this podcast on Facebook at Tree of Trust Podcast. Thanks for tuning in the Public Radio Hour. We hope you enjoyed the show. You can find a podcast of this program at WLRH.org and on iTunes by searching for the Public Radio Hour. And please share your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. Have a great night, and remember, try to do something good every day.